let's tell them about some gold.
Look, feel, style.
Oh yes, on this week's episode of The Elements on Business Daily, we revisit that most alluring of all members of the periodic table, gold. I'm Justin Rowlett, and today I'll be hearing both sides of an age-old debate. Why do we value gold at all?
Gold is really a decorative metal with a minimal industrial application.
The quantity of gold is limited, whereas the quantity of human stupidity and money printing is unlimited.
I also report from one country whose obsession with gold stretches back through the millennia.
Our entire culture and mythology has been dripping with gold.
Gold presents a bizarre paradox. In chemical terms, it is virtually useless. The metal is almost completely inert, yet it is also one of the most highly valued substances on the planet. So what makes gold so valuable? Well, it's a question we once put to our favourite chemist, Andrea Seller of University College London, at a magnificent exhibition of pre-Columbian gold artefacts at the British Museum.
That necklace is absolutely fantastic. They almost look like insect thoraxes.
They do, they've
linked together.
Locusts
really
strung together, golden locusts.
Stunning.
So we've come into, it's almost like a cavern. I mean, this is a wonderfully designed exhibition, isn't it?
And the pieces are just so extraordinary.
There's a lot of gold there, isn't there?
There's a lot of gold, and in these gold-obsessed days, I think, you know, we're immediately thinking of value.
What's interesting is to consider why, of all the elements, gold is this one that's become this kind of form of currency. So we have brought with us a periodic table, and I'm hoping, Andrea, that we will look at the alternatives. Why did an alternative element take the place of gold? So where would you like to start?
First of all, you know, you just can't use gases and liquids.
Right,
so the noble gases on the right-hand side, the halogens, those really aren't going to do it. It's very, very hard to carry around little files of gas, and they're colorless. So how would you know what it is?
Let's move to the other side.
The left-hand side, you've got the alkali metals and the alkaline earths. All of those are very, very reactive.
I mean, an explosive currency is not a good idea, is it?
No. You're left with that middle area, what we call the transition metals, the metals that we use for all kinds of structural, tough applications.
Okay, let's have a look at those. How many
iron,
are there?
Well, the 30. God, you almost had me there. But when you start looking at them in detail, each one has a problem. So many of them, for example, will tarnish. So it'd be lovely to have iron currency.
There's a lot of iron around.
There's loads of iron around.
It's quite pretty in its raw form.
It's easy to polish, but of course on a damp day or if you leave it lying around somewhere wet, you know that it's going to rust away. And so you have a self-debasing currency.
Yeah.
It's tremendous. And all the others, copper and zinc, all of those go off. Even silver is well known to tarnish. Most people, if they have silver, they have a little bit of polish at home.
So we're ruling out various elements. What have we got left?
We also have some very, very tough and durable elements on the left-hand side, titanium and zirconium, niobium, tantalum. The only problem is they're incredibly hard to smelt. And so if you actually want the metal itself, you need very, very high temperature furnaces. We're talking up of the order of 1,000 degrees.
So this is not the kind of temperatures that would have been available to the ancient man. So what have we got left?
So now what you've really got are either things that are easy to smelt or maybe things that you find lying around and that are durable. And within the periodic table, we often refer to platinum, palladium, rhodium, and iridium, along with gold and silver, as being the noble metals. But these are metals which are actually remarkably unreactive.
So here we've got a group of really promising metals. Now, why was gold chosen amongst these, do you think?
The beauty of gold is that, first of all, you do find little nuggets of it. And gold is incredibly inert. And on the other hand, relatively easy to melt. And so what that means is that you can pour your liquid gold into a mold, and then you know that it's going to be there for literally hundreds of years and isn't going to take much care and attention.
But here we've got an incredible paradox, haven't we, Andrea? We've got something that's inert and therefore chemically not very useful,
and yet something that is revered around the world as a great store of value.
Actually, gold is very, very useful to us. If you look at our electronics, you find that gold contacts are very widely used.
And the fact that it's inert and doesn't tarnish means the connections stay good.
That the connections stay good.
I mean, there is another really attractive element here, isn't there? Platinum, I mean, that's now a very valuable metal.
Chemists back in the 18th and early 19th century, the best thing that you could be given was a platinum crucible, because a platinum crucible was incredibly resistant. It didn't react with anything, and you could put it into very hot furnaces. And there's one of the secrets, is that its melting point is incredibly high. And so the flip side of its durability is the fact that it's actually much harder to work than gold. The one drawback with gold, and one of the reasons why, in fact, it wasn't always used for currency, is the fact that it's soft. And there's always that joke moment in movies when you see someone biting a piece of gold to see how pure it is. If it's really pure gold, then it's actually soft enough to bite.
And one of the staggering things about gold, there actually isn't really that much of it. Put it all together, it would be the size of a house, and that's all the gold that's ever been mined in the history of humanity.
And I know you want that house.
No, don't we all?
So if you were to make an iron currency, anyone could come along and start making their own coins. This isn't the case with gold. Gold scarcity means that it's harder to get at, and therefore perhaps it will hold its value better.
You know, there's very, very small amounts of palladium, for example.
Well, palladium, of course, wasn't discovered until the late 19th century. And so you've got to have that balance between availability at the same time as scarcity.
So just the right amount of scarcity.
Palladium and rhodium are too scarce. And the other thing is that they aren't distinctive. If you're someone who doesn't know any chemistry and all you see is a silvery metal, how do you know that what you've got is what you think it is? And the remarkable thing about gold is its yellow color.
It's very, very beautiful, isn't it?
There are only two metals that are colored. One is copper, which has that reddish color, and the other, of course, is the yellow gold.
Yeah, I'm going to have to ask you, Andrea, you know, explain to me, why is gold golden?
People have puzzled over this for hundreds of years, but of course in the last decades we've started to be able to really understand the electron structure of metals. And the interesting thing is that you cannot understand the electronic structure of gold simply using quantum mechanics, the theory that governs all of atoms and subatomic particles. And what you have to realize is that when you get to gold, the atom is so heavy and the electrons now move so fast that you now have to include Einstein's theory of relativity into the mathematics. What happens with gold is, because of relativity, it actually absorbs a little bit of blue light, and that's what gives us that gentle yellow sheen.
Everybody want a gold chain!
That was the ever-sparkling Andrea Seller of University College London. Now, there is one class of investor for whom gold has a particularly hypnotic appeal, the so-called gold bugs. They would argue that gold is still worth buying, even though it's lost some of its luster lately. The gold price is down about a third since its peak in 2011, and that fall has led some to tease the gold bugs and their loyalty to their metal. Barry Ritholtz, the New York-based financial advisor and author of the Big Picture blog, is one of them. In one blog post, he listed the 12 rules of gold bugs. To find out how accurate they are, I spoke to one investor famed for his love of gold, the Swiss financier Mark Faber.
The 12 rules of gold bugs. Number 1. Gold is a currency.
I'm holding gold because it's an honest currency whose supply cannot be increased very much. I always maintain cash, okay? Some of that cash, instead of holding it in British pound, that has been in a downtrend for the last 100 years, and in dollars whose purchasing power is also going down, some of that cash I keep in gold.
Number 2. The price of gold cannot fall. It can only be manipulated lower.
I think you would do very well in the long run by being in gold, provided it's not stolen away from you and not expropriated from you. They are, at times, better investments than gold. But if you had gold over longer periods of time, you kept more or less your purchasing power. At times, it was also taken away from you, like in 1933 in the United States. They wanna get my gold on the ceiling.
Number 5. Central bankers are printing money relentlessly, and this can only drive gold prices higher.
We don't have no time in the city of gold.
See, between 98 and today, the balance sheets of central banks has gone up 18 times. 1-8. Who is to say that it can't go up another 100 times in the next 10, 20 years? And when you print money, the value of money goes down. Maybe it goes down against real estate, against stocks, maybe against precious metals, against Ferrari cars, but against something it goes down. And I cannot store 20 Ferraris in my house, but I can store gold.
Number 7. Gold will survive after the world economy crumbles.
I just wanted you to know everything's gonna be alright.
Do you worry that there could be disasters in the future, that gold will be one of the few hedges that you could use against these crises?
Well, if you come to a ship and there's one place left on that ship, and you present to the captain a credit card, he will laugh at you. But if you give him gold or diamonds, he may take it. Big issue about gold is also where do you store it. Say, if I live in Thailand and my gold is all in Switzerland, I may not have access to it. So you have to have some gold where you actually are.
So do you have gold at home?
Yes, I do.
And you live in quite an interesting place, don't you? Tell us a bit about your home.
So when I'm not travelling, I like to be in a peaceful place, and I think Chiang Mai is quite good.
And Chiang Mai is the second city in Thailand, isn't it? Up in the mountains. It's a very beautiful place, but you also live in a place that's secure, isn't it, in the event of some catastrophe happening.
Well, I have Rottweiler dogs, but I suppose they can be bribed with a good steak. You know.
It's like gold dust, and you may come into your speakers.
Number 8. Never admit that gold is essentially a sucker's bet.
Gold is an asset class that has been stable, whereas equities, if you bought equities in 1929, most of the companies have gone bankrupt. The average lifetime of a company is precisely 30 years. Wow. And real estate maybe has performed better. But I can assure you, all the real estate in Eastern Europe and in Russia became worthless with the Russian Revolution and later with communism in Eastern Europe after the Second World War. So I factor in at all times uncertainty. And so my view is you should be diversified. Real estate, stocks, bonds, commodities, specifically gold.
Number 9. Gold is a rejection of government and their control of fiat money and finance.
The quantity of gold is kind of limited, whereas the quantity of human stupidity and money printing is unlimited.
Number 10. All gold discussions must contain ominous macro forecasts.
I think the whole financial system is going to collapse one day massively. I've seen disasters before. I've seen markets drop 90%. And I've seen really hardship in hyperinflation economies. I'm not worried because I'm 70 years old, so even if I have a tough time in the rest of my life, it's not the end of the world. That's 70 good years. But I advise every citizen, to own some gold. I know many people that have most of their money in gold. I don't have that much. I have about 25%. And that's what I'm recommending to people.
Don't sell your soul, baby, you a dirty girl.
Well, I do hope Mark Faber doesn't mind us teasing him just a little. And to be fair to him, he was quite open about the fact that gold can sometimes be a very bad investment, at least in the short term. And, as you heard, he also advocates limiting your gold holding to a mere 25% of your portfolio. But there are some investors who put all their money in gold. What motivates them? To find out, I spoke to the man behind those 12 rules, Barry Ritholtz.
Look, here's the thing. If someone wants to have 2 or 3% of their portfolio in gold as a hedge against inflation, I don't have a horrible objection to that. And in the 2000s, gold was really a great trading opportunity. But the people who sort of have drank the Kool-Aid, the people who are religious zealots, and we often see portfolios in my office where gold is 50 or 75% of their holdings. They don't practice good investment rules. They believe in myths. Even when the facts change, they don't change the stories. It's really quite amusing.
So what is the value of gold then?
So gold is really a decorative metal with a minimal industrial application. If I have a barrel of oil, I can convert that into plastics. I can burn it in my car. I can use it as a lubricant. I could do all these things with oil as a commodity. So that's the intrinsic value of a useful commodity. Same thing with stocks. If you buy an equity, you're buying a discounted cash flow in the future. You can get a sense of the growth rate of a company, its profitability, all these factors that allow us to figure out, do I want to own Disney or General Electric? With gold, you're basically making a bet that someone else is going to come along and pay more for gold than you paid. It's a speculative trade. That's very different than investing. You know, gold hit its peak in 1980, and on an inflation-adjusted basis, it still hasn't gotten over that peak. If you would have bought gold in 1980 when it hit 850, coincidentally, the Dow Jones Industrials were at about 850 the same time gold peaked at 850. Well, today gold is about 1,300 and the Dow Jones are about 18,000. So if you're a long-term investor, you have to think the bulk of my portfolio shouldn't be sitting in gold.
But what people who invest in gold would say that it has inherent value, that gold is something that's never going to be worthless because people will always want this wonderful element.
Well, that is true, but let me remind you that the market isn't especially stupid. The way I usually hear that phrase is, do you have any idea of how much gold buying is taking place in India and China? And the answer is always yes, and the market understands that, and it's already reflected in the price.
Okay, so you say these people are deluded. Why do they believe what you describe as these myths about gold?
Well, it's a fantastic story. It appeals to people's worst instincts. Recall what everybody was saying 5 years ago. The Fed and other central banks, they're going to cause hyperinflation. The dollar is going to collapse. You have to own gold in a period of collapsing dollar and hyperinflation. Well, what's happened since then? The dollar is at multi-year highs. Not only is there no hyperinflation, there's no regular inflation, and there's the threat of deflation. But the gold bugs never really changed their tune, and they kept buying gold, waiting for that hyperinflation. Look, gold goes through periods where it has this huge run. You could have picked up gold in the early 2000s for about 300. It ran up almost to 2000 before coming back down to about 1100 last year. If you're a trader, you want to play both sides of that move, the move up and the sell off down. The problem we see with true believers in gold is they'll ride it up and they ride it down, and net-net, a lot of these folks who came late to the party are now upside down in the gold holdings.
Look, you make a very powerful case. You're basically telling me that these guys are idiots, and yet some of them are clearly quite intelligent. Why do they believe these kind of myths?
It's not that they're idiots. It's that they're human beings. You name the asset class, and I could show you all of the really bad behaviors that people engage in. The human brain hasn't evolved to make risk-reward decisions in capital markets. And there are all manner of biases and cognitive errors that human beings succumb to. So humans as a species have a tendency to be overconfident. People's ability to evaluate their own skill set, so metacognition, meaning, hey, am I a good investor or not? The average investor lacks the skills to answer that question. They think they're great investors. They turn out to be mediocre at best. And one of the worst things that we see investors doing is something known as the endowment effect. Once you own something, you place a much higher value on that object than you would otherwise place if you didn't own it. A lot of this comes down to not wanting to look foolish. Hey, I bought it. It must have been for a good reason. I'm not stupid. So therefore, gold is going to go higher, and it's just having a temporary 6-year 40% setback. That endowment effect is true for stocks. It's true for bonds. It's true for just about anything else.
So what you're saying is that there's nothing exceptional about the gold bugs. The same issues apply to all investors.
That's exactly right. The gold bugs really manifest the worst of the investor behaviors in a way that is kind of hidden from view by stock investors. Stocks, especially indices, there's often a dividend. They perform better, so it covers up a multitude of sins. The real problem with gold is you're hoping for someone to pay more than you did, and that hope is never an especially good investment.
You are listening to an Element special on Business Daily with me, Justin Rowlatt, all about gold.
Number 12. China and India know the value of gold. The Western world does not.
They certainly pour money into buying the metal. Chinese consumers account for about a quarter of all gold demand. Indians, another fifth. In fact, the Indian lust for gold makes the metal one of the country's biggest import items. And I've come to India's most glamorous city to find out more about the country's obsession with gold. Mumbai is India's commercial capital and the home of Bollywood. So when it comes to bling, this is the place to find it.
Well, at least that's what I thought. I've arranged to meet the fashion features director of Indian Vogue, and my taxi has just dropped me off in a shabby mill complex in downtown Mumbai. So the cafe, apparently, is just down here. Let's see. Cafe Zoe, it's called. Down a little alleyway. And I begin to get the sense of this place. I think what we're going to discover is a bit of urban chic. Let's go in. Is this Cafe Zoe?
Yeah, Cafe Zoe.
Wow, and it is incredible. It's in an old mill building with great wrought iron beams and stripped wood tables. Bandana?
Hi.
Hiya, Bandana. Bandana Tawi. I'm Justin from the BBC. Very good to meet you.
Good to meet you too, Justin. Pon magal vandar, porul kodi
thandar, oomedai vasal pongum. So we're just having a glass of wine. And I want to talk to you about gold, because gold means quite a lot in Indian society, doesn't it?
Gold means a lot more than just sort of ornamentation. Our entire culture and mythology has been dripping with gold. For instance, the two biggest epics that came out of the Indian subcontinent, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana.
They're the foundation of Hindu religion and Indian society, aren't they?
Absolutely. It's full of references to gold being pure, signifying spiritual purity. And if you were rich, that you were also spiritually endowed. So the kings and the queens, how they would present themselves with their gold was very much to say, we are rich, therefore we are pure, therefore we are spiritually enhanced.
And I'm just checking you out to see how much gold you're wearing. And you haven't actually got that much. This isn't an ostentatious display.
So I come from a universe where I like gold, but I don't have to own it.
So do you think you represent a post-gold culture? Because the figures for how much gold's bought in India would suggest that you are the exception.
Oh, I am the exception. And having said that, there are many erudite young professionals like me who we don't like bling.
So wearing too much gold in your society in India would be considered kind of vulgar, would it?
Correct. But then I can't be the judge when I go to, let's say, a rural village and there's a festival or there's a wedding, and that is their way of living. But yes, too much gold to me personally is obnoxious and display of vulgarity that, you know. In fact, if they could just put that gold in a bank, that gold could be invested to make better roads. But apparently, that doesn't work. Indians love to take the gold biscuits and put it under the bed, you know?
That has always been part of the reason why people have been attracted to gold, because it is a store of value as well. So you'd be given the bangles on your wedding, but if it came to it, you could always sell them and buy food or clothes or whatever you needed.
You not only sold the bangles, some of the traditional saris that are woven in South India, for instance, they're called Kanjivaram silks. They're woven in gold thread. And in the olden days, God forbid you ran out of money and you were in debt, you burnt your sari, extracted the gold, and paid your debt. So you are a walking, talking bank. And therefore, people still believe that having biscuits of gold hidden behind the bricks of your wall is still a better investment than putting it in a bank. And you see this, what I find most fascinating are the temples. The richest temple in the world is the Tirupati temple in South India. Every top multinational bank has been trying to figure out, how do we get these temples to just invest their gold, you know? The donations to the gods. You know, I went to Tirupati temple many years back in South India, and I cannot tell you, you just get gobsmacked. You see mountains of gold.
And again, for the temples, it's a symbol of power as well, isn't it? And the way you talk about it, you can't help but be impressed when you see gold in those quantities.
It's like going to Vegas. You may hate it, but you're like, damn, what the hell is going on here? You want to sort of participate and take in the absurdity, but it is pretty obnoxious. You know, I love the stories that come out from the airports and how gold is being smuggled into India, right? Because the good old days when it was your tooth and all that is gone. Now it is in dolls. Millions of books that go out of the staples that are being used are in gold. Some daft person even put slabs of gold under the stickers for your luggage. And, of course, how would it not be noticed? They got a big bar of gold behind that sticker. And I find it fascinating to see how far people can go in their stupidity to think they get away with it.
And this is to avoid import duties, isn't it?
Of course.
But it strikes me that you work for Indian Vogue. You know, you're a kind of fashion leader. If people like you consider displaying gold vulgar, you know, that's going to permeate through Indian society, isn't it? There's going to be a change. Is India going to fall out of love with gold?
Absolutely not. Again, what are we talking about, India? India of Delhi and Bombay and three other metropolitan cities? Or are we talking of India that is 88% rural India, where gold is worshipped? Gold is the biggest transaction. It is who you are. You are literally weighed in gold. I have a cleaning lady who comes to my home, and she comes with her gold earrings, gold bank. She's got more gold than me, that's for sure. And her savings, I think every month they put something aside just to buy gold. It's just in our DNA. I mean, I grew up with my grandmother trying to bite the gold to check if it was real or not. I mean, everything was touch and feel. Every family had personal jewelers. There's always an occasion. The jeweler would come, that meant lunch had to be served and everyone would sit around and he'd open all these little velvet boxes and my granny was busy like biting into gold to see she was not getting cheated. It's just such a huge part of our culture. Like, if you don't like gold, you're pretty much not an Indian. So I may start off by saying I'm anti-bling and I think it's ostentatious. But the more I talk about it, I realize, damn, this is something special in this country. Like, we need to just have fun with it.
Bandana Tiwari, the fashion features director of Vogue India. Well, that is it for this episode. And now for the bad news. We have reached the end of the periodic table. Our exploration of the elements is drawing to a close. Next week's programme will be our last. But before you tear off your own ears in anguish, don't forget that you can still download extended podcasts of all 63 programmes in the series at bbc.com/elements. And as a special farewell treat, we've posted a video charting my descent into London's famous silver vaults. And that is not all. I am leaving you with a challenge. The podcast of this programme contains no less than 10 songs with gold in the title, including one one in Tamil. If you think you can name some of them, tweet your guesses to me. I am at BBC Justin R. Get them all right, and we may even arrange some very modest prize. It's a song.